regret. Even if he has to go down on his knees in that same marketplace, I'll make him, or he's no brother of mine. Aha, then it's only a suggestion, and it does not come from him, but simply from the generosity of your own warm heart. You should have said so. No. In that case, allow me to tell you of your brother's highly chivalrous, soldierly generosity. For he did give expression to it at the time. He left off dragging me by my beard and released me. You're an officer, he said, and I'm an officer. If you can find a decent man to be your second and send me your challenge, I'll give satisfaction, though you are a scoundrel. That's what he said. A chivalrous spirit indeed. I retired with Ilusha, and that's seen as a family record imprinted forever on Ilusha's soul. No, it's not for us to claim the privileges of noblemen. Judge for yourself. You've just been in our mansion. What do you see there? Three ladies, one a cripple and weak-minded, another cripple and hunchback, and the third not cripple, but far too clever. She's a student dying to get back to Petersburg to work for the emancipation of the Russian woman on the banks of the Neva. I won't speak of Ilusha, he's only nine. I'm alone in the world, and if I die, what will become of all of them? I simply ask you that. And if I challenge him and he kills me on the spot, what then? What will become of them? And worse still, if he doesn't kill me but only cripples me, I couldn't work, but I should still be a mouth to feed. Who would feed it, and who would feed them all? Must I take Ilusha from school and send him to beg in the streets? That's what it means for me to challenge him to a duel. It's silly talk and nothing else. He will beg your forgiveness. He will bow down at your feet in the middle of the marketplace, cried Alyosha again with glowing eyes. I did think of prosecuting him, the captain went on, but look in our code, could I get much compensation for a personal injury? And then Agrafena Alexandrovna sent for me and shouted at me, don't dare to dream of it. That is to say, Grushenka. If you proceed against him, I'll publish to all the world that he beats you for your dishonesty, and then you'll be prosecuted. I call God to witness whose was the dishonesty and by whose commands I acted. Wasn't it by her own and Fyodor Pavlovich's? And what's more, she went on, I'll dismiss you for good, and you'll never earn another penny from me. I'll speak to my merchant, too. That's what she calls her old man. And he will dismiss you. And if he dismisses me, what can I earn then? From anyone? Those two are all I have to look to, for your Fyodor Pavlovich has not only given over employing me, for another reason, but he means to make use of papers I've signed to go to law against me. So I kept quiet, and you've seen our retreat. But now let me ask you, did Ilusha hurt your finger much? I don't like to go into it in our mansion before him.
Yes, very much, and he was in a great fury. He was avenging you on me as a Karamazov, I see that now. But if only you'd seen how he was throwing stones at his schoolfellows, it's very dangerous. They might kill him. They're children and stupid. A stone may be thrown and break somebody's head.
That's just what has happened. He's been bruised by a stone today, not in the head but on the chest, just above the heart. He came home crying and groaning, and now he's ill.
And you know he attacks them first. He is bitter against them on your account. They say he stabbed a boy called Krasotkin with a penknife not long ago.
I've heard about that, too. It's dangerous. Krasotkin is an official here. We may hear more about it.
I would advise you, Alyosha went on warmly, not to send him to school at all for a time, till he's calmer and his anger is past.
Anger? The captain repeated. That's just what it is. He's a little creature, but it's a mighty anger. You don't know all, sir. Let me tell you more. Since that incident, all the boys have been teasing him about the wisp of tow. Schoolboys are a merciless race. Individually, they're angels, but together, especially in schools, they're often merciless. Their teasing has stirred up a gallant spirit in Ilusha. An ordinary boy, a weak son, would have submitted, have felt ashamed of his father, sir. But he stood up for his father against them all. For his father, and for truth and justice. For what he suffered when he kissed your brother's hand and cried to him, forgive father, forgive him, that only God knows. And I, his father. For our children, not your children, but ours, the children of the poor gentlemen looked down upon by everyone, know what justice means, sir, even at 9 years old. How should the rich know? They don't explore such depths once in their lives. But at that moment in the square when he kissed his hand, at that moment my Ilusha had grasped all that justice means. That truth entered into him and crushed him forever, sir. The captain said hotly again with a sort of frenzy,
and he struck his right fist against his left palm as though he wanted to show how the truth crushed Ilusha. That very day, sir, he fell ill with fever and was delirious all night. All that day he hardly said a word to me, but I noticed he kept watching me from the corner, though he turned to the window and pretended to be learning his lessons. But I could see his mind was not on his lessons. Next day I got drunk to forget my troubles, sinful man as I am, and I don't remember much. Mama began crying too. I'm very fond of Mama. Well, I spent my last penny drowning my troubles. Don't despise me for that, sir. In Russia, men who drink are the best. The best men amongst us are the greatest drunkards. I lay down, I don't remember about Ilusha, though all that day the boys had been jeering at him at school. Wisp of tow, they shouted. Your father was pulled out of the tavern by his wisp of tow. You ran by and begged forgiveness. On the third day when he came back from school, I saw he looked pale and wretched. What is it? I asked. He wouldn't answer. Well, there's no talking in our mansion without Mama and the girls taking part in it. What's more, the girls had heard about it the very first day. Varvara had begun snarling. You fools and buffoons, can you ever do anything rational? Quite so, I said. Can we ever do anything rational? For the time, I turned it off like that. So in the evening, I took the boy out for a walk. If you must know, we go for a walk every evening, always the same way, along which we're going now. From our gate to that great stone, which lies alone in the road under the hurdle, which marks the beginning of the town pasture. A beautiful and lonely spot, sir. Ilusha and I walked along hand in hand, as usual. He has a little hand, his fingers are thin and cold. He suffers with his chest, you know. Father, said he, father. Well, said I. I saw his eyes flushing. Father, how he treated you then? It can't be helped, Ilusha, I said. Don't forgive him, father, don't forgive him. At school they say that he's paid you 10 rubles for it. No, Ilusha, said I. I would not take money for him, for anything. Then he began trembling all over, took my hand in both his and kissed it again. Father, he said, father, challenge him to a duel. At school they say you're a coward and won't challenge him and that you'll accept 10 rubles from him. I can't challenge him to a duel, Ilusha, I answered. And I told briefly what I've just told you. He listened. Father, he said, anyway, don't forgive it. When I grow up, I'll call him out myself and kill him. His eyes shone and glowed. And of course, I am his father, and I had to put in a word. It's a sin to kill, I said, even in a duel. Father, he said, when I grow up, I'll knock him down, knock the sword out of his hand, I'll fall on him, wave my sword over him, and say, I could kill you, but I forgive you, so there. You see what the workings of his little mind have been doing these 2 days. He must have been planning that vengeance all day and raving about it at night. But he began to come home from school badly beaten. I found out about it the day before yesterday. And you are right, I won't send him to that school any more. I heard that he was standing up against all the class alone and defying them all, that his heart was full of resentment, of bitterness. I was alarmed about him. We went for another walk. Father, he asked, are the rich people stronger than anyone else on earth? Yes, Ilusha, I said. There are no people on earth stronger than the rich. Father, he said, I'll get rich. I'll become an officer and conquer everybody. The Tsar will reward me. I'll come back here, and then no one will dare. Then he was silent, and his lips still kept trembling. Father, he said, what a horrid town this is. Yes, Ilusha, I said, 'tisn't a very nice town. Father, let us move into another town, a nice one, he said, where people don't know about us. We will move, we will, Ilusha, said I, only I must save up for it. I was glad to be able to turn his mind from painful thoughts, and we began to dream of how we'd move to another town, how we'd buy a horse and cart. We'll put Mama and your sisters inside, we'll cover them up, and we'll walk. You shall have a lift now and then, and I'll walk beside, for we must take care of our horse. We can't all ride. That's how we'll go. He was enchanted at that, most of all at the thought of having a horse and driving him. Of course, a Russian boy is born among horses. We chattered a long while. Thank God, I thought, I've diverted his mind and comforted him. That was the day before yesterday in the evening, but last night everything was changed. He'd gone to school in the morning and came back depressed, terribly depressed. In the evening, I took him by the hand. We went for a walk. He would not talk. There was a wind blowing and no sun and a feeling of autumn. Twilight was coming on. We walked along, both of us depressed. Well, my boy, said I, how about our setting off on our travels?
I thought I might bring him back to our talk of the day before. He didn't answer, but I felt his fingers trembling in my hand. Ah, I thought, it's a bad job, the sunny fresh. We'd reached the stone where we are now. I sat down on the stone, and in the air there were lots of kites flapping and whirling. There were as many as 30 in sight. Of course, it's just the season for the kites. Looky, Lucia, said I. It's time we got out our last year's kite again. I'll mend it. Where have you put it away? My boy made no answer. He looked away and turned sideways to me, and then a gust of wind blew up the sand. He suddenly fell on me, threw both his little arms round my neck and held me tight. You know, when children are silent and proud and try to keep back their tears when they're in great trouble and suddenly break down, their tears fall in streams. With those warm streams of tears, he suddenly wetted my face. He sobbed and shook as though he were in convulsions and squeezed up against me as I sat on the stone. Father, he kept crying, dear father, how he insulted you. And I sobbed too. We sat shaking in each other's arms. Ilusha, I said to him, Ilusha, darling. No one saw us then, God alone saw us. I hope he will record it to my credit. You must thank your brother, Alexei Fyodorovich. No, sir, I won't thrash my boy for your satisfaction.
He had gone back to his original tone of resentful buffoonery. Alyosha felt, though, that he trusted him, and if there had been someone else in his, Alyosha's place, the man would not have spoken so openly and would not have told what he just told. This encouraged Alyosha, whose heart was trembling on the verge of tears.
"Ah, how I'd like to make friends with your boy," he cried. "If you could arrange it."
"Certainly, sir," muttered the captain.
"But now listen to something quite different," Alyosha went on. "I have a message for you. That same brother of mine, Dmitri, has insulted his betrothed, too, a noble-hearted girl of whom you've probably heard. I have a right to tell you of her wrong. I ought to do so, in fact, for hearing of the insult done to you and learning all about your unfortunate position. She commissioned me at once, just now, to bring you this help from her, but only from her alone, not from Dmitri, who has abandoned her, nor from me, his brother, nor from anyone else, but from her, only from her. She entreats you to accept her help. You have both been insulted by the same man. She thought of you only when she'd just received a similar insult from him. Similar in its cruelty, I mean. She comes like a sister to help a brother in misfortune. She told me to persuade you to take these 200 rubles from her, as from a sister, knowing that you are in such need. No one will know of it. It can give rise to no unjust slander. There are the 200 rubles, and I swear you must take them unless all men are to be enemies on earth. But there are brothers, even on earth. You have a generous heart. You must see that. You must." And Alyosha held out 2 new rainbow-coloured 100-ruble notes. They were both standing at the time by the great stone close to the fence, and there was no one near. The notes seemed to produce a tremendous impression on the captain. He started, but at first only from astonishment. Such an outcome of their conversation was the last thing he expected. Nothing could have been further from his dreams than help from anyone, and such a sum. He took the notes, and for a minute he was almost unable to answer. Quite a new expression came into his face.
"That for me? So much money? 200 rubles? Good heavens! Why, I haven't seen so much money for the last 4 years. Mercy on us! And she says she's a sister? And is that the truth?"
"I swear that all I told you is the truth," cried Alyosha. The captain flushed red.
"Listen, my dear, listen. If I take it, I shan't be behaving like a scoundrel. In your eyes, Alexei Fyodorovich, I shan't be a scoundrel. Alexei Fyodorovich, listen.
He hurried, touching Alyosha with both his hands.
"You are persuading me to take it, saying that it's a sister sends it. But inwardly in your heart, won't you feel contempt for me if I take it, eh?"
No, on my salvation, I swear I shan't. And no one will ever know but me, I, you and she, and one other lady, her great friend."
"Never mind the lady. Listen, Alexei Fyodorovich, at a moment like this you must listen, for you can't understand what these 200 rubles mean to me now."
The poor fellow went on rising gradually into a sort of incoherent, almost wild enthusiasm. He was thrown off his balance and talked extremely fast, as though afraid he would not be allowed to say all he had to say.
"Besides its being honestly acquired from a sister, so highly respected and revered, do you know that now I can look after Mama and Nina, my hunchback angel daughter? Dr. Hertzenstube came to me in the kindness of his heart and was examining them both for a whole hour. I can make nothing of it," said he, "but he prescribed a mineral water, which is kept at a chemist's here. He said it would be sure to do her good, and he ordered baths, too, with some medicine in them. The mineral water cost 30 kopecks, and she'd need to drink 40 bottles, perhaps. So I took the prescription and laid it on the shelf under the icons, and there it lies. And he ordered hot baths for Nina with something dissolved in the morning and evening. But how can we carry out such a cure in our mansion without servants, without help, without a bath, and without water? Nina's rheumatic all over. I don't think I told you that. All her right side aches at night. She's in agony. And would you believe it, the angel bears it without groaning for fear of waking us. We eat what we can get, and she'll only take the leavings, what she'll scarcely give to a dog. I'm not worth it. I'm taking it from you. I'm a burden on you. That's what her angel eyes try to express. We wait on her, but she doesn't like it. I'm a useless cripple, no good to anyone. As though she were not worth it when she is the saving of us all with her angelic sweetness. Without her, without her gentle word, it would be hell among us. She softens even Varvara. And don't judge Varvara harshly either. She's an angel too. She too has suffered wrong. She came to us for the summer, and she brought 16 rubles she'd earned by lessons and saved up to go back with to Petersburg in September. That is now. But we took her money and lived on it, so now she has nothing to go back with. Though indeed she couldn't go back, for she has to work for us like a slave. She's like an overdriven horse with all of us on her back. She waits on us all, mends and washes, sweeps the floor, puts Mama to bed. And Mama is capricious and tearful and insane. And now I can get a servant with this money. You understand, Alexei Fyodorovitch? I can get medicines for the dear creatures. I can send my student to Petersburg and buy beef. I can feed them properly. Good Lord, but it's a dream.
Alyosha was delighted that he'd brought him such happiness, and that the poor fellow had consented to be made happy.
Stay, Alexei Fyodorovitch, stay.
The captain began to talk with frenzied rapidity, carried away by a new daydream.
Do you know that Ilusha and I will perhaps really carry out our dream? We'll buy a horse and cart, a black horse, he insists on it being black, and we'll set off as we pretended the other day. I have an old friend, a lawyer in K province, and I heard through a trustworthy man that if I were to go, he'd give me a place as clerk in his office, so who knows, maybe he would. So I'd just put Mama and Nina in the cart, and Ilusha could drive, and I'd walk. Why, if I only succeed in getting one debt paid that's owing me, I should have perhaps enough for that too.
"There would be enough," cried Alyosha. "Katerina Ivanovna will send you as much more as you need, and you know I have money, too. Take what you want, as you would from a brother, from a friend. You can give it back later. You'll get rich, you'll get rich. And you know you couldn't have a better idea than to move to another province. It would be the saving of you, especially if you're a boy. And you ought to go quickly, before the winter, before the cold. You must write to us when you're there, and we will always be brothers. No, it's not a dream." Alyosha could have hugged him, he was so pleased. But glancing at him, he stopped short. The man was standing with his neck outstretched and his lips protruding, with a pale and frenzied face. His lips were moving, as though trying to articulate something. No sound came, but still his lips moved. It was uncanny.
"What is it?"
asked Alyosha, startled.
"Alexei Fyodorovitch, you—"
muttered the captain, faltering, looking at him with a strange, wild, fixed stare, and an air of desperate resolution. At the same time there was a sort of grin on his lips.
"You, sir, wouldn't you like me to show you a little trick I know?"
he murmured suddenly in a firm, rapid whisper, his voice no longer faltering.
"What trick?"
"A pretty trick,"
whispered the captain. His mouth was twisted on the left side, his left eye was screwed up. He still stared at Alyosha.
"What is the matter? What trick?"
Alyosha cried, now thoroughly alarmed.
"Why, look!"
squealed the captain suddenly, and showing him the two notes which he had been holding by one corner between his thumb and forefinger during the conversation. He crumpled them up savagely and squeezed them tight in his right hand.
"Juicy! Juicy!"
he shrieked, pale and infuriated, and suddenly flinging up his hand he threw the crumpled notes on the sand.
"Juicy!
he shrieked again, pointing to them.
Look there!
And with wild fury he began trampling them under his heel, gasping and exclaiming as he did so.
So much for your money! So much for your money! So much for your money! So much for your money!
Suddenly he darted back and drew himself up before Alyosha, and his whole figure expressed unutterable pride.
Tell those who sent you that the Wisp of Tow does not sell his honour,
he cried, raising his arm in the air. Then he turned quickly and began to run. But he'd not run 5 steps before he turned completely round and kissed his hand to Alyosha. He ran another 5 paces and then turned round for the last time. This time his face was not contorted with laughter, but quivering all over with tears. In a tearful, faltering, sobbing voice he cried,
"What should I say to my boy if I took money from you for our shame?"
And then he ran on without turning. Alyosha looked after him, inexpressibly grieved. Oh, he saw that till the very last moment the man had not known he would crumple up and fling away the notes. He did not turn back. Alyosha knew he would not. He would not follow him and call him back. He knew why. When he was out of sight, Alyosha picked up the 2 notes. They were very much crushed and crumpled, and had been pressed into the sand, but were uninjured and even rustled like new ones when Alyosha unfolded them and smoothed them out. After smoothing them out, he folded them up, put them in his pocket, and went to Katerina Ivanovna to report on the success of her commission. Part 2, Book 5, Pro and Contra. Chapter 1, The Engagement. Madame Holakoff was again the first to meet Alyosha. She was flustered. Something important had happened. Katerina Ivanovna's hysterics had ended in a fainting fit, and then a terrible, awful weakness had followed. She lay with her eyes turned up and was delirious. Now she was in a fever. They'd sent for Herrstenstube. They had sent for the aunts. The aunts were already here, but Herrstenstube had not yet come. They were all sitting in her room, waiting. She was unconscious now, and what if it turned to brain fever? Madame Holakoff looked gravely alarmed. "This is serious, serious," she added at every word, as though nothing that had happened to her before had been serious. Alyosha listened with distress, and was beginning to describe his adventures, but she interrupted him at the first words. She had not time to listen. She begged him to sit with Lisa and wait for her there.
"Lisa," she whispered almost in his ear, "Lisa has greatly surprised me just now, dear Alexei Fyodorovitch. She touched me too, and so my heart forgives her everything. Only fancy, as soon as you'd gone, she began to be truly remorseful for having laughed at you today and yesterday, though she was not laughing at you, but only joking. But she was seriously sorry for it, almost ready to cry, so that I was quite surprised. She's never been really sorry for laughing at me, but has only made a joke of it. And you know she is laughing at me every minute. But this time she was in earnest. She thinks a great deal of your opinion, Alexei Fyodorovitch, and don't take offence or be wounded by her if you can help it. I'm never hard upon her, for she's such a clever little thing. Would you believe it? She said just now that you were a friend of her childhood, the greatest friend of her childhood. Just think of that, greatest friend. And what about me? She has very strong feelings and memories, and what's more, she uses these phrases, most unexpected words, which come out all of a sudden when you least expect them. She spoke lately about a pine tree, for instance. There used to be a pine tree standing in our garden in her early childhood. Very likely it's standing there still, so there's no need to speak in the past tense. Pine trees are not like people, Alexei Fyodorovitch. They don't change quickly. Mama, she said, I remember this pine tree as in a dream. Only she said something so original about it that I can't repeat it. Besides, I've forgotten it. Well, goodbye. I'm so worried. I feel I should go out of my mind. Ah, Alexei Fyodorovitch, I've been out of my mind twice in my life. Go to Lisa. Cheer her up as you always can so charmingly. Lisa, she cried, going to her door, here I've brought you Alexei Fyodorovitch, whom you insulted so. He's not at all angry, I assure you. On the contrary, he's surprised that you could suppose so.
Merci, maman. Come in, Alexei Fyodorovitch.
Alyosha went in. Lisa looked rather embarrassed, and at once flushed crimson. She was evidently ashamed of something, and, as people always do in such cases, she began immediately talking of other things, as though they were of absorbing interest to her at the moment.
Mamma's just told me all about the 200 roubles, Alexei Fyodorovitch, and you're taking them to that poor officer, and she told me all the awful story of how he'd been insulted, and you know, although Mamma muddles things, she always rushes from one thing to another. I cried when I heard. Well, did you give him the money, and how is that poor man getting on?
The fact is, I didn't give it to him, and it's a long story, answered Alyosha, as though he, too, could think of nothing but his regret at having failed. Yet Lisa saw perfectly well that he, too, looked away, and that he, too, was trying to talk of other things. Alyosha sat down to the table and began to tell his story. But at the first words he lost his embarrassment and gained the whole of Lisa's attention as well. He spoke with deep feeling, under the influence of the strong impression he had just received, and he succeeded in telling his story well and circumstantially. In old days, in Moscow, he'd been fond of coming to Lisa and describing to her what had just happened to him, what he had read, or what he remembered of his childhood. Sometimes they'd made daydreams and woven whole romances together, generally cheerful and amusing ones. Now they both felt suddenly transported to the old days in Moscow, 2 years before. Lisa was extremely touched by his story. Alyosha described Ilusha with warm feeling. When he finished describing how the luckless man trampled on the money, Lisa could not help clasping her hands and crying out, "So you didn't give him the money, so you let him run away. Oh, dear, you ought to have run after him." "No, Lisa, it's better I didn't run after him," said Alyosha, getting up from his chair and walking thoughtfully across the room.
"How so? How is it better? Now they're without food and their case is hopeless."
"Not hopeless, for the 200 roubles will still come to them. He'll take the money tomorrow. Tomorrow he will be sure to take it," said Alyosha, pacing up and down, pondering. "You see, Lisa," he went on, stopping suddenly before her, "I made one blunder, but that, even that, is all for the best."
"What blunder? And why is it for the best?"
"I'll tell you. He is a man of weak and timorous character. He has suffered so much and is very good-natured. I keep wondering why he took offence so suddenly, for I assure you, up to the last minute, he did not know that he was going to trample on the notes. And I think now that there was a great deal to offend him, and it could not have been otherwise in his position. To begin with, he was sore at having been so glad of the money in my presence and not having concealed it from me. If he had been pleased, but not so much, if he had not shown it, if he had begun affecting scruples and difficulties, as other people do when they take money, he might still endure to take it. But he was too genuinely delighted, and that was mortifying. Ah, Lisa, he is a good and truthful man. That's the worst of the whole business. All the while he talked, his voice was so weak, so broken. He talked so fast, he kept laughing, such a laugh. Or perhaps he was crying. Yes, I'm sure he was crying, he was so delighted. And he talked about his daughters and about the situation he could get in another town. And when he'd poured out his heart, he felt ashamed at having shown me his inmost soul like that. So he began to hate me at once. He is one of those awfully sensitive poor people. What had made him feel most ashamed was that he'd given in too soon and accepted me as a friend, you see. At first he almost flew at me and tried to intimidate me. But as soon as he saw the money, he had begun embracing me. He kept touching me with his hands. This must have been how he came to feel it all so humiliating. And then I made that blunder, a very important one. I suddenly said to him that if he had not money enough to move to another town, we would give it to him, and indeed I myself would give him as much as he wanted out of my own money. That struck him all at once. Why, he thought, did I put myself forward to help him? You know, Lisa, it's awfully hard for a man who's been injured when other people look at him as though they were his benefactors. I've heard that. Father Zosima told me so. I don't know how to put it, but I've often seen it myself. And I feel like that myself, too. And the worst of it was that though he did not know up to the very last minute that he would trample on the notes, he had a kind of presentiment of it. I'm sure of that. That's just what made him so ecstatic, that he had that presentiment. And though it's so dreadful, it's all for the best. In fact, I believe nothing better could have happened.
Why? Why could nothing better have happened?
Cried Lisa, looking with great surprise at Alyosha. Because if he had taken the money, in an hour after getting home he would be crying with mortification. That's just what would have happened. And most likely he would have come to me early tomorrow and perhaps have flung the notes at me and trampled upon them as he did just now. But now he's gone home awfully proud and triumphant, though he knows he has ruined himself. So now nothing could be easier than to make him accept the 200 roubles by tomorrow.
He has already vindicated his honour, tossed away the money and trampled it underfoot. He couldn't know when he did it that I should bring it to him again tomorrow, and yet he's in terrible need of that money. Though he's proud of himself now, yet even today he'll be thinking what a help he has lost. He will think of it more than ever at night, will dream of it, and by tomorrow morning he may be ready to run to me to ask forgiveness. It's just then that I'll appear. Here, you're a proud man, I shall say. You've shown it, but now take the money and forgive us. And then he will take it. Alyosha was carried away with joy as he uttered the last words.
And then he will take it? Lisa clapped her hands. Ah, that's true. I understand that perfectly now. Ah, Alyosha, how do you know all this so young, and yet he knows what's in the heart? I should never have worked it out.
Well, the great thing now is to persuade him that he's on an equal footing with us, in spite of his taking money from us. Alyosha went on in his excitement, and not only on an equal, but even on a higher footing.
On a higher footing is charming, Alexei Fyodorovitch. But go on, go on.
You mean there isn't such an expression as on a higher footing? But that doesn't matter, because...
Oh, no, of course it doesn't matter. Forgive me, Alyosha, dear. You know, I scarcely respected you till now. That is, well, I respected you, but on an equal footing, but now I shall begin to respect you on a higher footing. Don't be angry, dear, at my joking,
she put in at once with strong feeling.
I am absurd and small, but you... Listen, Alexei Fyodorovitch, isn't there in all our analysis, I mean your analysis, no better call it ours, aren't we showing contempt for him, for that poor man, in analysing his soul like this, as it were from above, eh? In deciding so certainly that he will take the money?
No, Lisa, it's not contempt, Alyosha answered as though he'd prepared himself for the question. I was thinking of that on the way here. How can it be contempt when we're all like him, when we're all just the same as he is? You know, we are just the same, no better. If we are better, we should have been just the same in his place. I don't know about you, Lisa, but I consider that I have a sordid soul in many ways, and his soul is not sordid, on the contrary, full of fine feeling.
No, Lisa, I have no contempt for him.
Do you know, Lisa, my elder told me once to care for most people exactly as one would for children, and for some of them as one would for the sick in hospitals.
Ah, Alexei Fyodorovitch, dear, let us care for people as we would for the sick.
Let us, Lisa, I'm ready. I'm not altogether ready in myself. I'm sometimes very impatient, and at other times I don't see things. It's different with you.
I don't believe it. Alexei Fyodorovitch, how happy I am.
I'm so glad you say so, Lisa.
Alexei Fyodorovitch, you are wonderfully good, but you are sometimes sort of formal, and yet you're not a bit formal, really. Go to the door, open it gently, and see whether Mama is listening,
said Lisa in a nervous, hurried whisper. Alyosha went and opened the door and reported that no one was listening.
Come here, Alexei Fyodorovitch,
Lisa went on, flushing redder and redder.
Give me your hand. That's right. I have to make a great confession. I didn't write to you yesterday in joke, but in earnest.
And she hid her eyes with her hand. It was evident that she was greatly ashamed of the confession. Suddenly she snatched his hand and impulsively kissed it 3 times.
Ah, Lisa, what a good thing! Cried Alyosha joyfully.
You know, I was perfectly sure you were in earnest.
Sure? Upon my word?
She put aside his hand, but did not leave go of it, blushing hotly and laughing a little happy laugh.
I kiss his hand, and he says, what a good thing.
But her reproach was undeserved. Alyosha, too, was greatly overcome.
I should like to please you always, Lisa, but I don't know how to do it,
he muttered, blushing too.
Alyosha, dear, you are cold and rude. Do you see? He's chosen me as his wife, and he's quite settled about it. He's sure I was in earnest. What a thing to say. Why, that's impertinence, that's what it is.
Why, was it wrong of me to feel sure? Alyosha asked, laughing suddenly.
Ah, Alyosha, on the contrary, it was delightfully right,
cried Lisa, looking tenderly and happily at him. Alyosha stood still, holding her hand in his. Suddenly he stooped down and kissed her on her lips.
Oh, what are you doing?
Cried Lisa. Alyosha was terribly abashed.
Oh, forgive me if I shouldn't. Perhaps I'm awfully stupid. You said I was cold, so I kissed you. But I see it was stupid.
Lisa laughed and hid her face in her hands.
And in that dress,
she ejaculated in the midst of her mirth. But she suddenly ceased laughing and became serious, almost stern.
"Alyosha, we've put off kissing. We're not ready for that yet, and we shall have a long time to wait,"
she ended suddenly.
"Tell me, rather, why you, who are so clever, so intellectual, so observant, choose a little idiot, an invalid like me. Ah, Alyosha, I'm awfully happy, for I don't deserve you a bit."
"You do, Lisa. I shall be leaving the monastery altogether in a few days. If I go into the world, I must marry. I know that. He told me to marry, too. Whom could I marry better than you? And who would have me except you? I've been thinking it over. In the first place, you've known me from a child, and you've a great many qualities I haven't. You're more light-hearted than I am. Above all, you're more innocent than I am. I've been brought into contact with many, many things already.
Ah, you don't know, but I, too, am a Karamazov. What does it matter if you do laugh and make jokes, and at me, too? Go on laughing. I'm so glad you do. You laugh like a little child.
But you think like a martyr." "Like a martyr? How?"
"Yes, Lisa, your question just now, whether we weren't showing contempt for that poor man by dissecting his soul. That was the question of a sufferer. You see, I don't know how to express it, but anyone who thinks of such questions is capable of suffering. Sitting in your invalid chair, you must have thought over many things already."
"Alyosha, give me your hand. Why are you taking it away?"
murmured Lisa in a failing voice, weak with happiness.
"Listen, Alyosha, what will you wear when you come out of the monastery? What sort of suit? Don't laugh, don't be angry, it's very, very important to me."
"Ah, I haven't thought about the suit, Lisa, but I'll wear whatever you like."
"I should like you to have a dark blue velvet coat, a white piqué waistcoat, and a soft grey felt hat. Tell me, did you believe that I didn't care for you when I said I didn't mean what I wrote?"
"No, I didn't believe it."
"Oh, you insupportable person, you're incorrigible."
"You see, I knew that you seemed to care for me, but I pretended to believe that you didn't care for me to make it easier for you."
"That makes it worse, worse, and better than all. Alyosha, I'm awfully fond of you. Just before you came this morning, I tried my fortune. I decided I would ask you for my letter, and if you brought it out calmly and gave it to me, as might have been expected from you, it would mean that you did not love me at all, that you felt nothing and were simply a stupid boy, good for nothing, and that I'm ruined. But you left the letter at home, and that cheered me. You left it behind on purpose, so as not to give it back, because you knew I'd ask for it. That was it, wasn't it?"
"Ah, Lisa, it was not so, a bit. The letter is with me now, and it was this morning in this pocket. Here it is." Alyosha pulled the letter out laughing and showed it her at a distance. "But I'm not going to give it to you. Look at it from here."
"Why, then you told a lie. You, a monk, told a lie."
"I told a lie, if you like." Alyosha laughed too. "I told a lie so as not to give you back the letter. It's very precious to me," he added suddenly with strong feeling, and again he flushed. "It always will be, and I won't give it up to anyone." Lisa looked at him joyfully.
"Alyosha," she murmured again, "look at the door. Isn't Mama listening?"
"Very well, Lisa, I'll look, but wouldn't it be better not to look? Why suspect your mother of such meanness?"
"What meanness? As for her spying on her daughter, it's her right, it's not meanness," cried Lisa, firing up. "You may be sure, Alexei Fyodorovitch, that when I am a mother, if I have a daughter like myself, I shall certainly spy on her."
"Really, Lisa? That's not right."
"Oh, my goodness, what has meanness to do with it? If she were listening to some ordinary worldly conversation, it would be meanness. But when her own daughter is shut up with a young man... Listen, Alyosha, do you know I shall spy upon you as soon as we're married? And let me tell you, I shall open all your letters and read them, so you may as well be prepared."
"Yes, of course, if so," muttered Alyosha. "Only it's not right."
"Ah, how contemptuous. Alyosha, dear, we don't quarrel the very first day. I'd better tell you the whole truth. Of course, it's very wrong to spy on people, and of course I'm not right and you are. Only I shall spy on you all the same."
"Do, then, you won't find out anything," laughed Alyosha.
"And Alyosha, will you give in to me? We must decide that, too."
"I shall be delighted to, Lisa, and certain to, only not in the most important things. Even if you don't agree with me, I shall do my duty in the most important things."
"That's right. But let me tell you, I'm ready to give in to you not only in the most important matters, but in everything. And I'm ready to vow to do so now, in everything and for all my life," cried Lisa fervently. "And I'll do it gladly, gladly. What's more, I'll swear never to spy on you, never once, never to read one of your letters. For you are right and I'm not. And though I shall be awfully tempted to spy, I know that I won't do it since you consider it dishonourable. You are my conscience now. Listen, Alexey Fyodorovitch, why have you been so sad lately, both yesterday and today? I know you have a lot of anxiety and trouble, but I see you have some special grief besides. Some secret one, perhaps?"
"Yes, Lisa, I have a secret one too," answered Alyosha mournfully. "I see you love me since you guessed that."
"What grief? What about? Can you tell me?" asked Lisa with timid entreaty.
"I'll tell you later, Lisa. Afterwards," said Alyosha, confused. "Now you wouldn't understand it, perhaps, and perhaps I couldn't explain it.
I know your brothers and your father are worrying you, too."
"Yes, my brothers, too," murmured Alyosha, pondering.
"I don't like your brother Ivan, Alyosha," said Lisa suddenly.
He noticed this remark with some surprise, but did not answer it. "My brothers are destroying themselves," he went on. "My father, too, and they are destroying others with them. It's the primitive force of the Karamazovs, as Father Paisi said the other day, a crude, unbridled, earthly force. Does the Spirit of God move above that force? Even that I don't know. I only know that I, too, am a Karamazov. Me, a monk? A monk? Am I a monk, Lisi, who said just now that I was?"
"Yes, I did.
And perhaps I don't even believe in God."
"You don't believe? What is the matter?" said Lisa quietly and gently.
But Alyosha did not answer. There was something too mysterious, too subjective in these last words of his, perhaps obscure to himself, but yet torturing him.
"And now on the top of it all, my friend, the best man in the world is going, is leaving the earth. If you knew, Lisa, how bound up in soul I am with him, and then I shall be left alone. I shall come to you, Lisa. For the future we will be together.
Yes, together, together. Henceforward we shall always be together, all our lives. Listen, kiss me. I allow you."
Alyosha kissed her.
"Come now, go. Christ be with you." And she made the sign of the cross over him. "Make haste back to him while he's alive. I see I've kept you cruelly. I'll pray today for him and you. Alyosha, we shall be happy. Shall we be happy, shall we?"
"I believe we shall, Lisa." Alyosha thought it better not to go into Madame Holakoff and was going out of the house without saying goodbye to her. But no sooner did he open the door than he found Madame Holakoff standing before him. From the first word, Alyosha guessed that she'd been waiting on purpose to meet him.
"Alexey Fyodorovitch, this is awful. This is all childish nonsense and ridiculous. I trust you won't dream. It's foolishness, nothing but foolishness," she said, attacking him at once.
"Only don't tell her that," said Alyosha, "or she will be upset, and that's bad for her now."
"Sensible advice from a sensible young man. Am I to understand that you only agreed with her from compassion for her invalid state, because you didn't want to irritate her by contradiction?"
"Oh, no, not at all. I was quite serious in what I said,"
Alyosha declared stoutly.
"To be serious about it is impossible, unthinkable. And in the first place, I shall never be at home to you again, and I shall take her away, you may be sure of that."
"But why?" asked Alyosha. "It's all so far off.
We may have to wait another year and a half."
"Ah, Alexey Fyodorovitch, that's true, of course. And you'll have time to quarrel and separate a thousand times in a year and a half. But I'm so unhappy. Though it's such nonsense, it's a great blow to me. I feel like Famusov in the last scene of Sorrow from Wit. You are Chatsky and she is Sophia, and only fancy I've run down to meet you on the stairs, and in the play the fatal scene takes place on the staircase. I heard it all. I almost dropped. So this is the explanation of her dreadful night and her hysterics of late. It means love to the daughter, but death to the mother. I might as well be in my grave at once. And a more serious matter still, what is this letter she's written? Show it me at once, at once.
No, there's no need. Tell me, how is Katerina Ivanovna now? I must know.
She still lies in delirium. She's not regained consciousness. Her aunts are here, but they do nothing but sigh and give themselves airs. Herzenstube came, and he was so alarmed that I didn't know what to do for him. I nearly sent for a doctor to look after him. He was driven home in my carriage. And on the top of it all, you and this letter, it's true, nothing can happen for a year and a half. In the name of all that's holy, in the name of your dying elder, show me that letter, Alexei Fyodorovitch. I'm a mother. Hold it in your hand if you like, and I'll read it so.
No, I won't show it to you. Even if she sanctioned it, I wouldn't. I'm coming tomorrow, and if you like, we can talk over many things. But now, goodbye. And Alyosha ran downstairs and into the street. Chapter 2. Smerdyakov with a guitar. He had no time to lose, indeed. Even while he was saying goodbye to Lisa, the thought had struck him that he must attempt some stratagem to find his brother Dmitri, who was evidently keeping out of his way. It was getting late, nearly 3 o'clock. Alyosha's whole soul turned to the monastery, to his dying saint. But the necessity of seeing Dmitri outweighed everything. The conviction that a great inevitable catastrophe was about to happen grew stronger in Alyosha's mind with every hour. What that catastrophe was, and what he would say at that moment to his brother, he could perhaps not have said definitely. Even if my benefactor must die without me, anyway, I won't have to reproach myself all my life with the thought that I might have saved something and did not, but passed by and hastened home. If I do as I intend, I shall be following his great precept. His plan was to catch his brother Dmitri unawares, to climb over the fence as he had the day before, get into the garden and sit in the summer house. If Dmitri were not there, thought Alyosha, he would not announce himself to Foma or the women of the house, but would remain hidden in the summer house, even if he had to wait there till evening. If, as before, Dmitri were lying in wait for Grushenka to come, he would be very likely to come to the summer house. Alyosha did not, however, give much thought to the details of his plan, but resolved to act upon it, even if it meant not getting back to the monastery that day. Everything happened without hindrance. He climbed over the hurdle almost in the same spot as the day before, and stole into the summer house unseen. He did not want to be noticed. The women of the house, and Foma too, if he were here, might be loyal to his brother and obey his instructions, and so refuse to let Alyosha come into the garden, or might warn Dmitri that he was being sought and inquired for. There was no one in the summer house. Alyosha sat down and began to wait. He looked round the summer house, which somehow struck him as a great deal more ancient than before. Though the day was just as fine as yesterday, it seemed a wretched little place this time. There was a circle on the table, left no doubt from the glass of brandy having been spilt the day before. Foolish and irrelevant ideas strayed about his mind, as they always do in a time of tedious waiting. He wondered, for instance, why he had sat down precisely in the same place as before, why not in the other seat. At last he felt very depressed, depressed by suspense and uncertainty. But he had not sat there more than a quarter of an hour when he suddenly heard the thrum of a guitar somewhere quite close. People were sitting, or had only just sat down, somewhere in the bushes, not more than 20 paces away. Alyosha suddenly recollected that on coming out of the summer house the day before, he had caught a glimpse of an old, green, low garden seat among the bushes on the left by the fence. The people must be sitting on it now. Who were they? A man's voice suddenly began singing in a sugary falsetto, accompanying himself on the guitar. With invincible force I am bound to my dear. O Lord, have mercy on her and on me, on her and on me, on her and on me. The voice ceased. It was a lackey's tenor and a lackey's song. Another voice, a woman's, suddenly asked insinuatingly and bashfully, though with mincing affectation, "Why haven't you been to see us for so long, Pavel Fyodorovitch? Why do you always look down upon us?"
"Not at all," answered a man's voice politely, but with emphatic dignity. It was clear that the man had the best of the position and that the woman was making advances.
"I believe the man must be Smerdyakov," thought Alyosha, from his voice, "and the lady must be the daughter of the house here who has come from Moscow, the one who wears the dress with the tail and goes to Marfa for soup."
"I'm awfully fond of verses of all kinds if they rhyme," the woman's voice continued. "Why don't you go on?" The man sang again.
"What do I care for royal wealth, if but my dear one be in health? Lord, have mercy on her and on me, on her and on me, on her and on me."
"It was even better last time," observed the woman's voice. "You sang, 'If my darling be in health.' It sounded more tender. I suppose you've forgotten today."
"Poetry is rubbish," said Smerdyakov curtly.
"Oh, no, I'm very fond of poetry."
"So far as it's poetry, it's essential rubbish. Consider yourself whoever talks in rhyme. And if we were all to talk in rhyme, even though we're decreed by government, we shouldn't say much, should we? Poetry's no good, Maria Kondratyneva."
"How clever you are. How is it you've gone so deep into everything?"
The woman's voice was more and more insinuating. "I could have done better than that. I could have known more than that, if it had not been for my destiny from my childhood up. I would have shot a man in a duel if he called me names, because I'm descended from a filthy beggar and have no father. And they used to throw it in my teeth in Moscow. It had reached them from here, thanks to Grigory Vasilievich. Grigory Vasilievich blames me for rebelling against my birth, but I would have sanctioned their killing me before I was born, that I might not have come into the world at all. They used to say in the market, and your mamma, too, with great lack of delicacy, set off telling me that her hair was like a mat on her head, and that she was short of 5 foot by a wee bit. Why talk of a wee bit, while she might have said a little bit, like everyone else? She wanted to make it touching, a regular peasant's feeling. Can a Russian peasant be said to feel, in comparison with an educated man? He can't be said to have feeling at all, in his ignorance. From my childhood up, when I hear a wee bit, I'm ready to burst with rage. I hate all Russia, Maria Kondratyevna."
"If you'd been a cadet in the army or a young hussar, you wouldn't have talked like that, but it would have drawn your sabre to defend all Russia."
"I don't want to be a hussar, Maria Kondratyevna, and what's more, I should like to abolish all soldiers."
"And when an enemy comes, who's going to defend us?"
"There's no need of defence. In 1812 there was a great invasion of Russia by Napoleon, first emperor of the French, father of the present one, and it would have been a good thing if they'd conquered us. A clever nation would have conquered a very stupid one and annexed it. We should have had quite different institutions."
"Are they so much better in their own country than we are? I wouldn't change a dandy I know of for 3 young Englishmen,"
observed Maria Kondratyevna tenderly, doubtless accompanying her words with a most languishing glance. "That's as one prefers."
"But you are just like a foreigner, just like a most gentlemanly foreigner. I tell you that, though it makes me bashful."
"If you care to know, the folks there and ours here are just alike in their vice. They're swindlers, only there the scoundrel wears polished boots, and here he grovels in filth and sees no harm in it. The Russian people want thrashing, as Fyodor Pavlovich said very truly yesterday, though he is mad, and all his children."
"You said yourself you had such a respect for Ivan Fyodorovich."
"But he said I was a stinking lackey. He thinks that I might be unruly. He's mistaken there. If I had a certain sum in my pocket, I would have left here long ago. Dmitri Fyodorovich is lower than any lacquer in his behaviour, in his mind, and in his poverty. He doesn't know how to do anything, and yet he's respected by everyone. I may be only a soup maker, but with luck I could open a cafe restaurant in Petrovka, in Moscow. For my cookery is something special, and there's no one in Moscow except the foreigners whose cookery is anything special. Dmitri Fyodorovich is a beggar, but if he were to challenge the son of the first count in the country, he'd fight him. Though, in what way is he better than I am? For he's ever so much stupider than I am. Look at the money he's wasted without any need."
"It must be lovely, a duel," Maria Kondratyevna observed suddenly.
"How so?"
"It must be so dreadful and so brave, especially when young officers with pistols in their hands pop at one another for the sake of some lady. A perfect picture. Ah, if only girls were allowed to look on, I'd give anything to see one."
"It's all very well when you're firing at someone, but when he's firing straight in your mug, you must feel pretty silly. You'd be glad to run away, Maria Kondratyevna."
"You don't mean you would run away?"
But Smerdyakov did not deign to reply. After a moment's silence, the guitar tinkled again, and he sang again in the same falsetto. "Whatever you may say, I shall go far away. Life will be bright and gay in the city far away. I shall not grieve, I shall not grieve at all. I don't intend to grieve at all."
Then something unexpected happened. Alyosha suddenly sneezed. They were silent. Alyosha got up and walked towards them. He found Smerdyakov dressed up and wearing polished boots, his hair pomaded and perhaps curled. The guitar lay on the garden seat. His companion was the daughter of the house, wearing a light blue dress with a train 2 yards long. She was young and would not have been bad-looking, but that her face was so round and terribly freckled. "Will my brother Dmitri soon be back?" asked Alyosha with as much composure as he could. Smerdyakov got up slowly. Maria Kondratyevna rose too. "How am I to know about Dmitri Fyodorovitch? It's not as if I were his keeper," answered Smerdyakov quietly, distinctly, and superciliously. "But I simply asked whether you do know," Alyosha explained. "I know nothing of his whereabouts and don't want to. But my brother told me that you let him know all that goes on in the house, and promised to let him know when Agrafena Alexandrovna comes." Smerdyakov turned a deliberate, unmoved glance upon him. "And how did you get in this time, since the gate was bolted an hour ago?" he asked, looking at Alyosha. "I came in from the back alley over the fence and went straight to the summer house. I hope you'll forgive me," he added, addressing Maria Kondratyevna. "I was in a hurry to find my brother." "Ach, as though we could take it amiss in you," drawled Maria Kondratyevna, flattered by Alyosha's apology. "For Dmitri Fyodorovitch often goes to the summer house in that way. We don't know he's here, and he's sitting in the summer house."
"I'm very anxious to find him, or to learn from you where he is now. Believe me, it's on business of great importance to him."
"He never tells us," lisped Maria Kondratyevna.
"Though I used to come here as a friend," Smerdyakov began again, "Dmitri Fyodorovitch has pestered me in a merciless way, even here by his incessant questions about the master. What news, he'll ask, what's going on in there now? Who's coming and going, and can't I tell him something more? Twice already he's threatened me with death."
"With death?"
Alyosha exclaimed in surprise. "Do you suppose he'd think much of that with his temper, which you had a chance of observing yourself yesterday? He says, if I let Agrafena Alexandrovna in and she passes the night there, I'll be the first to suffer it. I'm terribly afraid of him, and if I were not even more afraid of doing so, I ought to let the police know. God only knows what he might not do."
"His Honor said to him the other day, 'I'll pound you in a mortar,'" added Maria Kondratyevna.
"Oh, if it's pounding in a mortar, it may be only talk," observed Alyosha. "If I could meet him, I might speak to him about that, too." "Well, the only thing I can tell you is this," said Smerdyakov, as though thinking better of it. "I'm here as an old friend and neighbour, and it would be odd if I didn't come. On the other hand, Ivan Fyodorovitch sent me first thing this morning to your brother's lodging in Lake Street, without a letter, but with a message to Dmitri Fyodorovitch to go to dine with him at the restaurant here in the marketplace. I went, but didn't find Dmitri Fyodorovitch at home, though it was 8 o'clock. He's been here, but he'd quite gone." Those were the very words of his landlady. "It's as though there was an understanding between them. Perhaps at this moment he's in the restaurant with Ivan Fyodorovitch, for Ivan Fyodorovitch has not been home to dinner, and Fyodor Pavlovitch dined alone an hour ago and has gone to lie down. But I beg you most particularly not to speak of me and what I've told you, for he'd kill me for nothing at all."
"Brother Ivan invited Dmitri to the restaurant today," repeated Alyosha quickly.
"That's so."
"The Metropolis Tavern in the marketplace?"
"The very same."
"That's quite likely," cried Alyosha, much excited. "Thank you, Smerdyakov. That's important. I'll go there at once."
"Don't betray me,"
Smerdyakov called after him. "Oh, no, I'll go to the tavern as though by chance. Don't be anxious."
"But wait a minute, I'll open the gate to you," cried Maria Kondratyevna.
"No, it's a short cut. I'll get over the fence again."
What he had heard threw Alyosha into great agitation. He ran to the tavern. It was impossible for him to go into the tavern in his monastic dress, but he could inquire at the entrance for his brothers and call them down. But just as he reached the tavern, a window was flung open, and his brother Ivan called down to him from it.
"Alyosha, can't you come up here to me? I should be awfully grateful."
"To be sure I can, only I don't quite know whether in this dress, but I'm in a room apart. Come up the steps, I'll run down to meet you."
A minute later, Alyosha was sitting beside his brother. Ivan was alone, dining. Chapter 3. The Brothers Make Friends. Ivan was not, however, in a separate room, but only in a place shut off by a screen, so that it was unseen by other people in the room. It was the first room from the entrance with a buffet along the wall. Waiters were continually darting to and fro in it. The only customer in the room was an old, retired military man drinking tea in a corner. But there was the usual bustle going on in the other rooms of the tavern. There were shouts for the waiters, the sound of popping